You're listening to El Clásico, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España, from Barcelona to Madrid. Today, we're in Zaragoza.
You are indeed listening to El Clásico. My name is Daniel Freeber and I'm the host of this episode. And I am in Zaragoza, the capital of Aragon, and frequently described as the city of the celebrated late 18th and early 19th century painter Francisco de Goya. Despite the fact that he was born 44 kilometers from here, a route that Ryanair would embrace centuries later to lure tourists to tiny provincial airports in the vague vicinity of major cities. In his teens, Goya traveled to Italy to immerse himself in that country's glorious artistic heritage. According to some sources, traveling to Rome with a gang of bullfighters and soon finding work as a street acrobat, then an aide to a Russian diplomat. He also apparently became infatuated with a nun whom he planned to abduct from her convent. Inspired by all of this, tonight's guest is another émigré who undertook a similarly, formative voyage to Italy and has since led an equally colourful life. It's El Barón, the great Dane, Brian Nygaard. Clean Eagle. Brian, have you ever been a street acrobat or abducted a nun?
Let me just quickly think about that. No, I haven't. I was just browsing through the formative wilder years, you know, but none of those things occurred.
But Brian, I did read that. I read that life story, that very colourful life story, and I did think of you. I don't know if that's any comfort or slightly alarming. You have led a very colourful life.
He's certainly a painter that I like a lot. So I'm thankful for that connection. You know, whenever I go to Madrid, those are some of the paintings I would seek out. But yeah, but thank you.
Brian, do you know much about Zaragoza? I was looking forward to visiting. This is one of Spain's biggest cities. I think it's the fifth or sixth biggest city in Spain. About 600,000 people live here. It's not a city I know very well. It's quite a grand city with some very splendid monuments. We didn't see many of them today. I was slightly disappointed that the finish line wasn't closer to some of the main sites in Zaragoza. At the moment, I'm in a crowded bar, as you may be able to hear, surrounded by some of the sort of early evening movida in Zaragoza, but we didn't get to see too much of it. Have you been here? Do you know it?
Yeah, but only via the Vuelta. But I have to say, though, it always reminds me, and this is a recommendation to you and our dear listeners, there's a very fine book called The Manuscript Found in Zaragoza. Have you ever heard about that? Have you ever read it?
Not familiar with it.
Okay, so it's actually written by a Polish author and an account called Jan Potocki, but it's old Moorish ghost stories, all set in the Sierra Morena Mountains in the 18th century Spain. And it's a fantastic series of ghost stories, adventure stories, a lot of them quite funny, quite quirky, a little bit goth. It's a fantastic book. I can highly recommend it, and it's also translated into English.
Doesn't sound like suitable nighttime reading for the Vuelta a España, though, Brian. You know, I've got a job to do here. I don't want to be spooked before I go to bed.
It is still, certainly, there's also ghost stories, proper ghost stories. Do you believe it?
I've got enough things to deal with. Speaking of ghosts of the Vuelta's past, maybe, in Zaragoza, one thing I did expect, Brian, or hoped about today's stage, was that it might be very fast, because there's a precedent, isn't there? There are several precedents for certainly windy stages, and one extremely fast tailwind stage in the Vuelta a España in 2001 that finished in Zaragoza. Fastest Grand Tour stage of all time, 3 hours and 14 minutes to do 179 kilometers, 55.17 kilometers an hour, much faster than the fastest stage ever in the Giro. That was in 2020, Matera Brindisi. And the fastest stage in the Tour de France was way back in 1999. That was 50.36 kilometers now, won by Mario Cipollini. There wasn't much wind today, Brian. I should also say that stage of the Vuelta in 2001 was won by Igor González de Galdeano, who was a kind of a GC rider. And I watched some of the tape of that day, and it was literally, if you imagine a peloton, a bunch being blown by a hurricane at their backs, it was a bit like that. And I don't think Igor González de Galdeano even intended to attack. He just sort of caught a favourable gust of wind and ended up winning the stage. But Brian, shall we find out exactly what did happen today, 22 years on from the stage we've just been talking about?
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Brian, what happened today?
Well, thank you, Daniel. I should be able to do the fastest ever tale of the etapa on this stage, the stage 12 from Olvega to Zaragoza, 150.6 kilometers. A two-rider breakaway dominated the day by someone, I think, from Vuelta lovers, Jetse Bol, a fairly known figure because he was, I think he was 1 year trailing very closely to the leader's jersey. And he was joined in his attack by Abel Balderstone. Is this the right pronunciation, Daniel? You would be the only one to know.
I think it is the right pronunciation if you are British,
which is not.
Balderstone, his dad was British. I'm going to endeavour in the next couple of days to find out exactly where his father was from. But Balderstone, as the Spaniards call him, is very much Spanish, or very much Catalan. In fact, he grew up in a place called Ullastrell, was close to Barcelona, I believe, and spent all his life there. Our good friend and colleague Fran Reyes had a long conversation with Balderstone yesterday at the start, and told me subsequently that he doesn't even speak particularly well great English. I'm sure it's perfectly fine, but I don't think he's bilingual. He's very much Spanish. If he does have a second language, it is probably Spanish. In fact, his first language may well be Catalan, but we'll maybe find out more about him in the coming days.
I mean, if it wasn't for that interjection, this would have been the fastest one. Either way, nothing but they built up a decent gap, but it was soon to diminish once the bigger teams started to gun their engines. A crash by six riders later in the stage was luckily no one, I think, got seriously hurt. With 45 kilometers, Balderstone struggled to hang on after Ball accelerated. He got dropped. With 39 kilometers to go, Ball was then caught by the chasing peloton. It was a fairly straightforward run into Zaragoza once they crossed the bridge across the river, at least. But what looked like a penalty shoot without a goalkeeper for Alpecin Koenig turned into a kind of like a mad chase more than a sprint, because it looked like Caden Groves stepped out of his pedal and had to do his first sprint just to get back up. But by then, Molano had already been launched brilliantly by Oliveira and won his second ever Vuelta stage. It was actually at least as impressive that Caden Groves finished second, because he actually had to do a sprint just to get back up and then a sprint to try and win the stage. But yeah, there he was. Very visibly annoyed by what had happened, but equally joy on the UAE team with Molano's win.
Brian, there was one tiny change on general classification, not change of positions, but a change in the standings, wasn't there? Which tiny, but possibly significant, and we're going to hear about it in just a moment. Primoz Roglic took two bonus seconds, unexpectedly. Just consulting the standings now, what did it do to the time gaps themselves as we go into, well, this big weekend in France tomorrow?
Yeah, massive one. So, I mean, he's obviously still in fifth. He's now 132 behind his teammate Kuss, with Remco Evenepoel being 109. So he edged a little bit closer to Evenepoel.
Brian, we'll maybe talk about the thinking behind that move, if it can be considered a tactical move later. Maybe once we've heard from Primoz Roglic, which we will do in just a second. But before we do hear from some of the protagonists today, Brian, the move that, well, you mentioned Caden Groves there having an issue, chain jumping, it looked like. We're going to find out more about what exactly did happen to him in just a second. But the move from Rui Oliveira and Sebas Molano, the eventual stage winner, it struck me that had that been a bit later, 50 metres, 100 metres, 200 metres closer to the finish line, if it was a sprinter sort of moving that far across the road and not a lead-out man, then maybe there would have been some cause or a case for disciplinary action or a disqualification. What do you think?
Well, it was a really wide road. I mean, there was one of the widest boulevard sprints you see in this world apart from Madrid. And I think the fact that the other decapitated lead out train was more towards the middle and or the other side of the road. So I think they don't really disturb anyone majorly by doing that move. It's a pretty brilliant move because it's a three man lead out, or that ended up being just that one brilliant lead out by Oliveira. But I didn't see anything that, I mean, normally they sanction quite oftentimes they sanction quite hard for those types of moves. But yeah, apparently not today. I don't think it was sanctionable either, to be honest.
I mean, it's a bit like the argument in football that sometimes we see fouls happen in the penalty area that are overlooked and the same foul goes punished somewhere else on the field. Yeah. And similarly, I do get the feeling sometimes that there are moves in the middle of stages and, well, in this case, in the lead out, that if transposed to the sprint itself. We always talk about sprinters changing lanes, deviating in the sprint. It seems to me that the commissaires are a little bit more permissive when it comes to anything that happens before the last sort of 300, 400, 500 metres. However, Brian, as you said, Sebas Molano did get his second Vuelta stage win. Of course, he won the final stage in Madrid last year, which was an unusual one because he was the guy who was supposed to be leading out in Madrid last year, and it was supposed to be Pascal Ackermann who was sprinting for UAE, but Molano just so happened to be faster on that occasion. And they came in, did they come in 1 and 2 or 1 and 3? It was quite bizarre. And, well, it was so emphatic today that Rui Oliveira was able to sprint to, was he fourth in the end, Brian?
Yes.
Those first sort of 3 or 4 riders were a long way ahead, and partly because of the lack of strong sprint trains, as we've spoken about before in this Vuelta, and partly because it was, well, an outstanding lead out by Rui Oliveira. And
but Alpecin had like the lead out to win the bike race. I mean, they were perfectly aligned. I don't know if it's either the pedal or the chain. He definitely lost his balance to a point where he had to, like, he lost all of his kick, all of his acceleration just as he was about to start. But their lead out train would have been perfect if it had. I mean, he had a bit 1,200 meters to go. He had like his complete lead out train at his disposal.
Well, Brian, it was pretty disappointing. Caden Groves spoke to us at the finish line, spoke to me and my colleagues from Eurosport, GCN, and a few others. We're also going to hear from Rui Oliveira. I mentioned his outstanding lead out. He was pretty ecstatic after the finish line. And we're also going to hear from, you know what I mean, Primož Roglič, about those 2 bonus seconds that he gained today, and, well, why exactly he was going for bonus seconds.
Got bumped by UAE, who came with momentum, and my chain actually dropped, so I managed to get it on. I think I showed a really strong sprint, but unfortunately it was too far back, too late.
Because at the end it looked like you were catching Molano even in the last few hundred metres.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I'm in good shape, and like I say, the guys got me fresh into the final, and in the end it was an unlucky mechanical, I think. I had to come from quite a long way back, and yeah, I think I showed my speed anyway.
Rui, congratulations. Just talk us through your job in the lead out and how you pulled it off.
Yeah, today we knew it would be a sprint I would have to time pretty well because it was a bit of head crosswind and was always slightly bending to the left. So I knew we would have to time it really well. I had patience this time. Molano wanted to go like 600. I just was trying to follow, find the right moment. And like for 50 to go, I just find the gap. I knew it would be on my wheel. Like, luckily I had the legs to do a really good lead out. And just seeing finishing first, I'm so proud.
Describe that feeling. What is it? Is it relief mainly after, well, a lot of sprints where you've executed well, but you haven't got the victory?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I've done so many lead outs in these last 5 years with this team, and sometimes there would be Grand Tours that I would have done so many seconds and thirds with really good lead outs. So the work really doesn't show when you don't win, no? So to be able to pull a really good lead out and our sprinter delivers is something pretty special. I mean, we come with the GC team mainly, and it's just me and Molano, you know. We had pretty hard stages the first week. Also had a few crashes. The first stages, actually, I didn't know I was going to survive the following days. But it's just to make a friend win, make a teammate win, for me is always so special, and to make it in a Grand Tour, I'm speechless.
Yeah, it's nice, no? To gain something. Sometimes you gain a bit, sometimes you lose.
What was already the plan then, to be up there in the intermediate sprints?
But not really, but then I was there, and I went for it.
How important are these seconds, do you think, in this Vuelta?
we see at the end.
Well, you think it's needed because tomorrow on Tourmalet the differences will be much more.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. We will see. Tomorrow, new day and new challenge.
Does it cost too much energy, you think?
Oh, we'll see. I don't care, really. Thank you.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, Brian, we heard there from, oblique as ever, Primoz Roglic. I feel as though, I don't know, who were the publishers that used to bring out phrase books and, well, dictionaries, you still get those, the sort of tourism, Hugo, was it? Hugo phrase book? I feel as though someone should bring out a Roglicism.
It should actually be you, Daniel, to be honest. This is like, you could hire yourself, for that.
Does any of it mean anything? I'm not really sure.
Not to him, it doesn't.
No. Feels like you need sort of special glasses or special headphones.
Yeah, yeah. Or like, you know, remember those books when we were kids with dinosaurs and you had to like put them further away and all of a sudden there was a pattern that you hadn't seen up until then. Maybe there is like a side to Roglic that's like just will completely one day like completely mystify everything and turns out to be...
I'm sure someone somewhere out there is developing some kind of advanced AI 4D technology that will finally be able to translate Primoz Roglic's thoughts into, well, the kind of language that we understand. We also heard there from Rui Oliveira. I said he was ecstatic. He was very proud. That was the first time that he had contributed, I believe, to a sprint win in a major tour. It's his fourth major tour. And yeah, always really nice to do an interview like that. Quite often, we approach days like today as sort of routine days, transitional days, and I think as we said earlier on in the Vuelta, there are always riders in the peloton for whom, and Brian, you'll have seen this many, many times working for teams, for whom it is potentially, well, it's career defining. We saw that with Geoffrey Soup in the last sprint finish.
When you look at the start list at any Grand Tour, which you have done a million times, you'd be surprised how many riders are in that position where, you know, they will go through, you know, major parts of the season, and even for people who follow the sport quite closely, you couldn't exactly pinpoint the moment where they were extremely relevant and mission crucial for their team. But if you pull that, it's a bit like a bass player in a band. If you take them out of the mix, you immediately see that there's something missing. It's only the big super teams that can sometimes, if they lose a guy or two, they have strong enough riders to figure out what they need to do. Other teams don't, even some of the bigger teams don't. Either it be a road captain or someone that can make sure that the sprinter gets positioned well, or someone that just has the horsepower. I mean, imagine if today had been a crosswind stage, if the wind was blowing a gale, you would probably see some of those. I mean, unfortunately, we didn't see it because there wasn't any TV coverage of it the other day. But then you'll see those types of riders. You really see why it makes so much sense for any team to rely on, because if someone like Oliveira, this guy with a massive engine, and they want to be relevant. They want to be part of a victory, and that's really that's their job.
I'm always quite sort of intrigued and in a way impressed by the way UAE have, well, they've stuck with some of their sprinters and they've continued to invest in the sprint team. We heard Oliveira say there that basically it's him and Molano at this Vuelta a España. But unlike other teams, that once they get a sort of a taste, a bite of the Grand Tour cake, then they really lean into that and they completely dispense with any other objectives, and everyone who joins the team is essentially a Grand Tour domestique. UAE have kept this sort of small but still relatively significant sprint division, and Molano himself, I mean, he's a rider who's had some issues in the past. Last year at the Dauphiné, I remember when he had altercation with Hugo Page. He's quite an explosive character, and they obviously have quite a lot of faith in him, and they've been rewarded. And it struck me today as well that there's this sort of private battle going on between Jumbo-Visma and UAE to be the number one team in the world and to end the year as the number one team in the world. And today will have been very valuable in that light. Of course, over the weekend, Brian, well, Jumbo-Visma will be pursuing another goal, some would say a more important goal, and you know, this historic goal of winning three Grand Tours in a year. You know, I've been talking about it with some colleagues over the last couple of days, Brian, and what would make that even more impressive would be doing it with three different riders. Almost unfathomable, in fact, that they could possibly do that, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially if the third guy has done and been a major part of the former two. That is just, I mean, at least as impressive, being that guy. But just one brief thing about what we spoke about before, you know, when with Jumbo Visma, for instance, it was obvious that they had to let Dylan Groenewegen go because he wanted to win tour stages and there was no room for him. So I was actually quite surprised when they kept Olav Kooi because, I mean, he's winning bike races left to right and he's potentially a superstar in that part of those types of stages. So I don't know.
I think Kooi didn't win in the Tour of Britain today. I think I think his goose might be cooked now.
Yeah, I still think he has the potential to win in any type of a Grand Tour or even a bigger race than the Tour of Britain. But I was quite surprised that they would keep him because he would know that, you know, he knows already that he's not going to do the Tour next year. I find that completely impossible to imagine. But still, yeah, it's those big teams that are many faceted as UAE is actually quite. I think it's great, and also goes to show that they know they have one of the biggest stars now, actually two or three of the biggest stars in Grand Tours, but still they invest in and they take out riders who could potentially help, say Ayuso better than the ones they have, and it's old school in a way that I quite appreciate. We don't see that very often.
Brian, we're going to talk a lot more about the Tourmalet in tomorrow's stage later on. We're going to focus on the route in particular later on. But obviously, tomorrow will be billed, I suppose, as a battle between Remco Evenepoel and the Jumbo-Visma Troika, the Trident. That is Sepp Kuss, the race leader, Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic. And Brian, we haven't spoken for a few days. You haven't been on the pod for a few days. Just give us your sort of 25,000-foot view of... well, Jumbo over the last few days, and maybe your countryman as well, Jonas Vingegaard.
Well, it was really impressive the way Sepp Kuss did the time trial. You know, given his, I think, probably pretty minuscule preparation, one riding a time trial, but also riding one in such an important part of the Grand Tour. Wearing the leader's jersey, I thought that was really impressive. I know that Evenepoel said he wasn't as good as he was hoping to be, but it was a good enough time trial. I mean, it's not like we saw in the Giro as well, even when he wasn't at his best, he was still the better rider in the time trial, you know, the one he won before he exited in this year's Giro. But I think looking from the outside, and that's taking everything into consideration, I think Primoz Roglic is the strongest rider in the Vuelta, and he is my absolute favorite for winning. It would take a different, but it would. And he's obviously not gonna. He's not gonna ride aggressively to try and win the race because his teammate is in the leader's jersey. But I think there'll be so many attacks from Evenepoel. I think in the race will be extremely hard because of the pace that Jumbo-Visma will try and set, especially tomorrow. So I think that it'll be a two horse race against Roglic and Evenepoel.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean. Brian, this morning at the start in particular, just talking casually to a lot of people about how they saw things, it seems to me that confidence is growing in Sepp Kuss as his own confidence is growing. But you and I speak about this a lot, and people are very trigger happy when it comes to sort of declaring Grand Tour GC battles over long before, well, long before the fat lady has started to loosen her vocal cords, shall we say. And it seems to me that's the case at the moment. You know, we heard from Larry Warbass, the lucky Larry, the Motorsound Maestro, yesterday, maybe trying to make amends for having suggested the previous day that Sepp Kuss wasn't going to keep the jersey in the time trial. But yesterday, Larry said, oh, you know, a minute, or just over a minute, it's a lot to lose just on, I don't know, a few attacks from Remco on explosive finishes. But, you know, you look at Sepp Kuss's record in stage races, I think I mentioned it yesterday. He hasn't really done any stage races of any note in the last few years as the team leader with any great success. He hasn't done many, full stop, as the leader. He hasn't won a stage race since 2018, and he is very green. I suppose as a Grand Tour leader, of course. I suppose on the flip side of the coin, he doesn't really have a lot of pressure, does he? And
no.
Speaking to people in and around the team, they have talked about the fact that Sepp Kuss is a very relaxed individual anyway. He's a very selfless individual, as we've heard repeatedly over the last few days. But also, the team, well, Sepp Kuss has fulfilled his objectives for the year. He's basically provided the assist for team leaders to win the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia. And I'm sure if you'd asked him at the start of the year whether he thought he would do the Vuelta, he would have said no. So yeah, it's all been a bit of a bonus, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But even taking that into consideration, I still think that they would really like him to win. Mm. You know, I don't think they have... Normally wouldn't say, oh, would you prefer this guy or that guy? But given his position and given how he's worked for the others, I think they would really like to see him win. But it's just with the remaining stages and everything, if you stack everything up against what can happen, you know, with his... I think experience is not as important because he's in a team with a wealth of experience, with riders with a wealth of experience, you know, sporting directors who know what to do. But I still think that internally they would like him to win. But the problem is, though, that they can't build a race where it suits him. They have to build a hard race that needs to be as hard as possible, or else it's too dangerous with someone like Evenepoel's trailing so close behind. So it will eventually be the strongest rider from Jumbo-Visma, and I just see that as Roglic at the moment. And I know a minute is in modern cycling is a lot, but when you take into consideration what we still have to see in this race, it's not.
Brian, it feels as though Sepp Kuss winning this Vuelta, someone who has contributed to so many Grand Tour victories over the last few years, as the team has built towards their current status as the best team in the world, they're sort of zeroing in on a success, an accomplishment which would put them in the conversation as one of the best teams ever. It feels as though Sepp Kuss winning the Vuelta a España would be a sort of apotheosis, a real kind of culmination, everything that the project has been about for a few years coming together. Maybe the sort of acme, maybe the zenith for this team. You know, we've seen with Team Sky, Ineos, it looked at one stage as though this was a team that was going to be invincible for years and decades. And there's inevitably a plateau that's followed by, well, a decline. And that usually comes when other teams start to copy what you're doing, learn your secrets. And, you know, also, we can't deny that for all that Jumbo-Visma have been very shrewd in their talent scouting, they've also been incredibly lucky. They were incredibly lucky to find Primoz Roglic. Okay, not many teams would have taken the gamble that they took on him. But he's been a project-defining rider for them. So much has stemmed from having him in the team. But on that, Brian, on talent scouting and exactly how these riders, Jonas Vingegaard as well, how they came to be where they are today, I thought it would be useful, instructive, to start to kind of piece together or recap, remind ourselves a bit of the Sepp Kuss story, how he ended up where he is today. Of course, he started life as a cyclist, as a mountain biker, and in 2016 he was riding for a small team sponsored by Harley Davidson, of all people. Gateway Harley Davidson, they were called, a small domestic team in the United States. Sort of started turning heads when he won stage two of the Redlands Bicycle Classic on the famous in that race Oak Glen climb. And this prompted another American team, Rally Cycling, to swoop for him, sign him mid-season. They took him on, and the following year he rode some bigger races, including the Tour of California, where what was then, I think, Lotto NL Jumbo were also present, also riding. There was one ride in that race that was quite noteworthy. He finished 10th on Mount Baldy. Lotto NL Jumbo's captain, I think, at that race, Robert Hastings, finished 9th. And this was the ride that really caught the attention of Jumbo-Visma. This morning, spoke to Grisha Neerman, one of the Jumbo-Visma director sportifs, who was more responsible, I think, than any of the others for getting Sepp Kuss on board with a ship at that point that was starting, well, it was moving out of some fairly turbulent water in the team's history, and was starting to move towards the sort of success that they're enjoying now. You were the guy who sort of spotted Sepp or sort of pointed him out to the management in 2017 Tour of California. Is that right? What did you see there?
I see potential. Saw a potential World Espana winner. Now,
He was on what was then rally, and first of all, I think he finished eighth or ninth on Mont Baldy. But I was even more impressed. I remember the last stage, we were in the lead with George Bennett, and there was quite a hard final stage, which we desperately tried to control. And there was a strong front group away, and then I think Seppi went across by himself on a climb of 3-4k. He went across solo to the front group and then pulled the whole day in front because I think one of his teammates won back then. And that impressed me quite a lot. So that same night I went to him, and there was a little party in the hotel. And I remember going to him and asking him for his telephone number, and that we would be interested. And he was pretty drunk, but he still gave me the number, and that's how it started.
A lot of guys have come over from the States and they've struggled in Europe because the racing's so different, the roads are so wide there. Did you have those concerns, reservations about him?
Yeah, he didn't have an easy time to start with. Like, I think when he first came over in the winter, he gained quite a lot of weight, and he didn't have a good start of the season. He was really struggling, and I think it was then from that year's Tour of California in 2018 that we saw he's going better and better. Then he won, that year already Colorado, Utah, I won, I think. Afterwards, we took him to the Vuelta, where, in hindsight, after a week, we thought, we should have sent him in the break because he would have won every mountain stage. And when we sent him in the break, he was the first one dropped because he was already after 10 days. He progressed little by little from there, and I think also his wife Noemi played a big part in that, because he's half Spanish now, and I think he really feels at home in Andorra, where he lives, and I think that's a big part of him really settling in Europe, and that's also a part of his success.
And in that phase, Grisha, so 2017, when you were going to races as sports directors, was that part of your responsibility, your brief, to look out for young talent? Was the team particularly looking for climbers, 22, 21 year olds at that time?
No, but of course we're always looking for young talents, and back then it was still a little bit different. Like right now, of course every junior already has a manager, and we do a lot of scouting via our development team. But back then I just came out of the development team ranks when I was with Rabobank development team as director. I mean, we also always did some scouting on the road, and that's also, for example, how we found Jonas. It's basically contacts with still like sport directors that I knew back from that time, and then we got into contact with Jonas and we signed him. I think it's developing a little bit into another direction, that right now if you want to have a top rider, you almost have to sign him when he's a junior, but in 2017-2018 I also did part of the scouting still before we had a development team, and I mean that's still the case, of course, when we see young riders, potentially good riders in the races, then I talk about that with Marijn and with Mathieu, we get into the interest, and then we find out who's the manager, and we talk to them, or we talk to the rider in the first place. I think in our team at least, we look for the riders we want to have, and we are not waiting for offers from managers like, oh, this rider is free, do you want to, are you interested? I think with us it works a little bit the other way around.
And then last thing, Grisha, so it sounds as though it was a relatively easy negotiation. It's not like there were 10 teams who were trying to sign him, there was a manager who was conducting an auction.
No, at that time Sepp already had a manager, I think, we were always in the lead. I actually don't know exactly if there were other teams also after him, or if he had more offers, but I think we did an ergo test, and that also showed really a lot of potential, and then we gave him a contract, that's how it started.
Remco, if I say Tourmalet, what images, what words come into your head, if any?
I did a recon of this one, so I don't know it. I know it, but I don't know it very well. But of course, Tourmalet is one of the mountains that, when you speak about cycling, it pops in your head. It's like Mont Ventoux, Angliru, Mortirolo, you know, these climbs, Son Colan. It's just one of those climbs that everybody knows.
Are you interested in the history of it? Do you know much about the history of it?
I don't know a lot about the history of it, actually.
You and a lot of other riders.
Joe Dombrowski from Astana Kazakhstan team. I would associate it more with the Tour de France than the Vuelta. I don't think I've ever done it. But let me check and come back to you on that, because...
It's like going to the Vatican and then someone asking you 5 years later, or I don't know, the Colosseum, or I don't know if I've been there.
Yeah, but you know, we go so many places, and there's two things that I've found how you know you've been somewhere as a bike racer. Strava, because you know, you start perusing the map and it's like, oh, I didn't know I did this climb, but you know, I have a time on it, right? And then the other thing is Wi-Fi. You know, you show up to the hotel and your phone's already on the Wi-Fi. It's like, I guess I've been here before.
Shameful. I'm going to start covering another sport. You should be ashamed of yourself. You know, this is a mountain that bleeds history, folklore. This is what I was hoping you were going to say.
I'll check on Strava tonight if I've done it, and I'll let you know.
Lewis Askey, Groupama FDJ.
Just wanted to ask you one thing. The Tourmalet. Any experiences with it? What comes into your head when I say Tourmalet?
Well, luckily I've never done it before, so...
I've asked about 20 people today, none of them have done it.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm more scared. I mean, yeah, of course it's a brutal stage, but I think at the end of the day it's so brutal that it's kind of... There's going to be a big group out that trying to push through together. It's probably, like, for us guys, there's not a lot we can do, and I... Personally, I predict that Jumbo are going to try and ride pretty hard on every single climb. So for us, it probably is quite a day of survival. I'm honestly more scared for this other one we've got coming up. What's it called now? Aringlu or something?
Angliru.
Yeah, this one, because I'm at the moment I'm reading, I'm going through a few different books, and one of the old ones was David Miller's one from quite a few years back. And he's talking about that at the moment, and I found out we do that in this world, so yeah, I'm not so excited for that one.
It's strange to call yourself a king, you know, but people like to call me like this, I like it, it's funny, but myself calling me King Kenny, I would find it a bit, no? What do you think?
In all honesty,
what you would think if I would start to call myself King Kenny?
Yeah, my impression of you would change. Okay, just introduce yourself normally. Say your normal name and who you ride for.
I am Kenny Ellison, riding from Little Trail. You know, I almost did the world.
I say Tourmalet. What do you say?
France. Mountain, France, long, altitude.
Mythical, yeah, legendary.
Yeah, mythical, legendary, queen stage. Often, no?
Do you like it? Is it a climb that you like?
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Spandau a little bit less. It's really a small road out, but Obisk, I like it also. I was second like long time ago. I like this climb also, but yeah, Tourmalet is mythical. You always like to, like, it smells also like the Tour de France, you know, it's this kind of climb, so yeah, it's gonna be heavy.
Okay, my name is Larry Warbass, and I'm also known as the Motown Maestro. To be honest, I don't know if I've ever done it. I guess it's hard. I don't know. I was looking at it the other day. I don't know, maybe I've done it as like an under 23 or something, but I'm not really sure. I have to like look a bit harder, but I'm sure it's gonna be really hard tomorrow. Was there like a big battle between Schleck and someone else?
Contador.
Is that where he dropped his chain or something?
No, it wasn't, but that was the same tour.
Okay, well, I'm close. Getting close, yeah. I don't really know much else, to be honest.
Well, Brian, I sent you that little montage earlier in the day, and I think you were as aghast as I was.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I can't say that I'm surprised. You and I have talked about this both on and off the podcast over the last years. And I appreciate the honesty, you know, that there's absolutely no embarrassment about this complete, like, they're just void of historical background of the sport. I mean, not totally. I think they all have childhood heroes. But the places where cycling has been defined, supposed to have a bunch of time to think about a lot of things when they're out on these long training rides or when they're sitting up on the top of Teide. but reading books about the history of cycling, certainly, or audiobooks, is not one of them.
Well, we heard Lewis Askey there at least is trying. I mean, he's a young rider, and we should cut him some slack. He's at least trying to.
But don't you remember wasn't it the first stage, tour stage, that Peter Sagan won? And Bernard Hinault was on the podium congratulating him. And he had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
poor Bernard Hinault. I mean, he's an absolute legend, even in you know, for younger generations than ours.
Brian, I'm sure Henri Desgranges listens to the cycling podcast every night in his grave, and I'm sure he's spinning. Or Eugène Christophe. Can you imagine them? You know, the sort of among the forefathers of the Tour de France. Can you imagine them hearing that? Brian, on that note, maybe we should hear from someone who does know a bit more about the Tourmalet, i.e. you. Let's hear about tomorrow's stage, what we've got in store, shall we?
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Brian, I'm not going to tell listeners about the dinner. Well, I did have dinner again last night, but we were in Soria last night. We mentioned it yesterday. The town, the closest big town to the beautiful, beautiful finish that I waxed lyrical about on the Laguna Negra. And Soria, what a beautiful surprise that was. Town, little sort of provincial town of about 40,000 people, lots of very beautiful buildings, monuments, and mushrooms are the speciality of Soria. Mushrooms sort of foraged in the surrounding hills, mountains, woods, and we had some last night, and quite splendid it was too. But Brian, we've got, well, one of the dishes of the Vuelta a España tomorrow, but it's a French dish.
I'll take it, you know. Now, tomorrow is bound to be really spectacular, not just because of where we are in the race and the GC, but by the race route itself. It's super short, but it's all up and down, and there's some legendary climbs in it as well. It just starts with a little bit of a climb and a long descent to the Col d'Aubisque. So we're just in the Pyrenees terrain that we know so well from the, well, at least you and I know so well from the Tour de France. And there's no flat kilometers. There's not even much of a plateau anywhere on this 134 kilometer stage. And after the Col d'Aubisque, they climb the Col de Spandel, and then it's downhill to the valley, and then up on the, which I believe must be the western side of the Col du Tourmalet. A pure, short and very very hard climbing stage with 4,000 plus climbing meters. It'll be a huge bike race from the go. Without a doubt.
Brian, I was speaking to some of our colleagues and our mutual friend Søren from TV2, Danish television, at the finish. And I know he spoke to Jonas Vingegaard this morning and asked Vingegaard whether he thought he might get some freedom, some latitude to try an early attack tomorrow. And Vingegaard suggested that may indeed be the case. A couple of questions. One, is that a good idea? Is that going to be useful for Jumbo-Visma? And well, two, do you think that he can do whatever the team's goal is for him tomorrow? Do you think his form is where it needs to be to have a serious impact on the race tomorrow?
I doubt that it's at that level, but the fact that the question mark about it is imminent, it also means that other riders are in doubt of how, you know, how deep into the stage he can go and how far out he can stay there. And don't forget, he's only, and I'm putting that in brackets, and he's been a bit of on a downward slope, especially from the time trial, judging from his current shape. But if you look at the riders who are surrounding him, who are in the same time, you know, Ayuso, Almeida, they're not going to let him go. You know, it's not like, even if he's strong, and even if they have to have a strong card to play, even in the earlier part of the race, there are other riders who just can't afford to let Vingegaard go, because he's going to take over their positions in the GC if he gets away with it. So I highly doubt that he will be able to go early. He might like to, and he might have to be a card that they need to play at some point in the stage, but I think it'll have to be maybe on the later ramps on the Obisque, or maybe not even until they call the Spandel. I don't think he'll get away before that.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? When people talk about early attacks...
I mean, this is 134 kilometer stage with all mountains. Yeah. It can only be early, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some people's early is the obisque, you know, between sort of after 35 kilometers. Other people's early is at the bottom of the Tourmalet.
The bottom of the Tourmalet would make a lot of sense, because normally when they set up their strategy for a stage like this, they'll say, well, we need to be pulling as hard as humanly possible for at least for the last, say, like 2 hours. We'd need to take full control of the stage. Tomorrow is different because it's so short. And then when you think of it, you know, with Kuss in the leader's jersey, with Roglic being potentially the guy who will have to take on Evenepoel, either on Sepp Kuss's behalf or to try and win the race himself, they'll have to use Vingegaard constructively. And that could either be like setting a nasty tempo, but I don't think that's enough to really put Evenepoel in danger or in problems. And so an early attack, early in the sense, either Spandell or at the bottom of the Tourmalet would make sense. Because if they don't have anyone who can pull at a high level, an attack might be better. Because then they actually play the card that he needs, that he can potentially be. Because if he gains a minute, someone will have to do something.
Question, if somehow tomorrow, I don't know what would lead to this scenario, but say, I don't know, Remco Evenepoel attacks somewhere, and Primoz Roglic is the only Jumbo-Visma rider. Well, he's the only one out of Primoz Roglic and Sepp Kuss who can follow Remco. What do you think the instructions to Jonas Vingegaard will be at that point? How early do Jumbo-Visma decide to cut their losses and decide that, well, this was a nice idea that Sepp Kuss was going to win the Vuelta a España, but the two best cards they have are Vingegaard and Roglic? Or do you think they're ready to risk the chance of, well, having two riders up there in order to keep Sepp Kuss in contention?
I don't think they'll have a choice when that situation arises in front of them. You know, because on the steeper parts of the climbs tomorrow, on the last part of the stage with so much climbing already in the legs, you don't really strategize that much anymore. And don't forget that they have a very strong team here, but they don't really have that many climbing domestiques who are able to fight for them, you know, because usually that would be Sepp Kuss. So he's instrumental in that. So the only option would be, let's say, that if Kuss is in trouble and Evenepoel rides away with Roglic on his wheel, then they will have to try and see if Vingegaard can bridge that gap. But I find that once you're in trouble on a stage like tomorrow, how are you going to repair? How are you going to all of a sudden feel better? And that, all of this is on the premises that Evenepoel will have a great day tomorrow, which I think he will. And I think he looks really good. Even if the time trial was a little bit subpar for him, what I saw on the other stages, he just rides with such great confidence, and he's definitely not intimidated by Jumbo-Visma at all, on the contrary. So I think that once you hit that point in the race, you don't strategize, you really just have the strongest guys will have to ride away.
Just mentioning Remco, I'm not going to ask you how he's going to ride tomorrow, well, you've already said you think he's going to have a good day tomorrow, and well, he'll certainly be in the fight. Just from a PR perspective, we've sort of done this before, since you have such a lot of experience as a PR man for teams. Just watching Remco over the last few days, you know, I spoke to him again in the mix end this morning, and it just seems that the guy loves to talk, and his answers are so rich, they're so detailed. And as a result, inevitably, there are going to be times where he either shares too much information, or he shares information too maybe quickly, impulsively, in the wrong place, in the wrong context. But what have you made of what you've heard and seen of his sort of press conferences, interviews over the last week?
I think it happened already at the Giro for me that I'm a convert. I'm flying the Remco flag all the way. He's grown on me immensely. I think what we saw at the Giro was a lot more, I wouldn't say mature, but just someone that's definitely has a little bit of a different mindset. And I think that includes how he moves around in the peloton and how he gets along with his colleagues from other teams. And I think he's a smart rider, actually. I think he's tactically quite astute for his age and his experience. I think he's very well spoken in English. My Flemish is not good enough to really see how good he is with the Belgian media, but they seem to take a lot of his time, so there must be something going on in those conversations. Yeah, he's impressed me. I really have to admit that I've really come to like him, because I mean, when you think of it, what he's up against here, you know, with it. And I think he's also been able internally to motivate his team in a way where they perform, I think, out of their, they're punching above their weight collectively. And that takes a leader as well, and a leader that's, you know, not by fear, but by sympathy. I think that's the best way to get it out of him. And I think that's what he does. He installs a lot of confidence in him. And he delivers. I think he's more, he would, if let's say if he was the strongest rider here by far, and he wouldn't have any real sort of worries in the last week, but he's not, right? He's definitely has other riders who, and a team that's very intimidating. But how he goes on about that, I think it adds a lot of interesting stories to tell about his ability also mentally to take on those things. He's really impressed me.
Incidentally, talking about Belgium and the Belgian journalists and Remco, they're going to have a lot of fun. Well, they're going to have some great content over the next few years, some great material, because Remco, as we said, is a fantastic speaker, loves to talk. Another one who does is Kian Utebroeks, the unpronounceable, as we have rechristened him, affectionately, very That's affectionately.
Fantastic.
I was speaking to one of the Bora Hansgrohe PR people, press officer this morning, and she said that he loves to talk. He loves to talk, even on the bus in the morning. The hardest part of her day is to stop him talking. Yeah, we've certainly enjoyed our time with him in Vuelta starts.
One thing I've noticed is that, you know how in the leading up to the Vuelta there was so much talk about Remco going to other teams, you know, either going to Ineos or them fusioning with Lefebvre and all of that, and you're on the ground, and you it's not like the Marca and Ask, the two big Spanish sports papers, they're not shy of running with a little bit of gossip, but those stories have just completely evaporated. And they would only really come to the fore again if either something actually happened in real life, or if his team was just completely not up to the task, right? I mean, if they were just nowhere to be found and he had to struggle on his own for the last two climbs, but they've actually been really good for what they are, and if you look at them man for man, and I think the atmosphere around Remco and that team has probably also changed a bit, I think.
We're going to conclude with a prediction, if you will. Just as the Italians say, pronostico secco, just a straight prediction, please, for tomorrow's stage.
Okay, so I will say that Roglic will win, but he'll be trailing with Evenepoel on his wheel. He'll Roglify Evenepoel, but he's not going to be able to take out seconds. But I do think that the jersey will go to Evenepoel.
The Tourmalet is going to be Roglified for the first time. Maybe then the Gen Z representatives in the pro peloton will learn about the Tourmalet's legendary status in the sport. Brian, my prediction, I'm going to sort of be pragmatic, you could say Machiavellian, in order to shoehorn in an interview, I'm going to predict that Hugh Carthy, I don't know how, but Hugh Carthy is going to win on the Tourmalet tomorrow. Hugh Carthy, he has a habit of winning on mythical summits. He's won on one at least, the Angliru in the Vuelta a España. He's 13th on general classification. It's had an interesting race so far. And I said we're going to shoehorn in an interview. I sort of teased this yesterday. I said that the meeting of the day today had been conducted yesterday, and it was a chat I had at the start in Lerma with Hugh Carthy. So we're going to play out with that. Hugh Carthy on his Vuelta, on some changes that he's seen in the sport over the last few years. Not on how he's going to win tomorrow, but, well, that is what's going to happen on the Tourmalet. Brian, it's been a pleasure as always.
Likewise, Daniel. Thank you very much.
El encuentro del día. The meeting of the day.
Things gonna be better and feeling okay. I think a couple of stages before the last two uphill finishes weren't necessarily sort of my thing, but especially the one where the one before the rest day with the bit up and down and sprinty and stuff. But yeah, in general, feeling pretty good. Time trial went okay yesterday. It didn't feel amazing, but the result was okay. It's where I wanted to sort of be a minimum, so I was happy with that. So yeah, see what happens this week.
Can you talk a bit about your preparation for this race? Obviously now, you know, we hear a lot about guys spend a lot of time at altitude. Some haven't, Vingegaard hasn't. What was your month before the race like?
To be honest, not great. I was Tour de Lan, had a crash with a concussion and injuries and stuff, so and a few days off the bike there, and then I had a bit of a stomach problem, and that meant I had to miss Burgos. So then coming here, it wasn't really ideal. It was a bit sort of not really sure what was going on, but yeah, I knew I was going to probably get better if my health was okay. I'd get better, but anyway, I don't like to dwell on that. It's sort of water under the bridge or a Grand Tour. It's time to sort of correct everything. So, yeah, I was in one piece when I started. We did okay in the team time trial. We got that together on the night, and things went from there. So, yeah, I think we started in a good place. Did okay to get that move on stage five or whatever it was. That was a bit of a lucky, but I was in the right place, and it turned out quite a nice little bonus that to get back into the game. I'm pretty happy where I'm at. You look at the GC now, and yeah, to get into the top 10 is going to be extremely difficult with the riders ahead of me, but at the moment I'm not going to give up trying. I think something's got to give up there as well. There's too many riders from the same team and stuff, so I think at some point some people are going to have to work for other people and maybe drop back. So
he was watching the video back from Laguna Negra last time, 2020. It seems a long time ago when you watch back. And that was the first Grand Tour after COVID, or the first season after COVID. Do you sort of think there was a before and after? Do you feel that there was a bit of a quantum leap with around about that time with COVID?
No, I think it was brewing. I think when I turned professional, I think that was when everything started to get a bit more for younger riders. Bernard was probably the first riders to be those sensation. And then I can't remember who was next. Then Roglic was at this sensation that came. He was already professional. He'd already been there a few years, but it took him a while to find his feet. But yeah, I don't think there's been a big jump. I wouldn't say it was due to COVID or after that period. I don't know. I think all sports in general are more professional over the years. Keep about 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. So I think cycling's got more professional. I think until the past sort of say 10 years, I think there wasn't as much science. It was just two wheels, a bike, and put your kit on and go. Now with the nutrition and the technology, even to do with tyre sizes and selecting different tyres, stuff like that, it makes a big difference. And if you're one season behind in development, stuff like that, you're a long way behind now, especially in a time trial or uphill finish. And I think the competition as well. I think with the level being higher, everyone training to a higher standard and living to a higher standard, taking things more, like I say, the level of professionalism has gone up. I think it's made it more competitive. So everyone's fighting for more, and it's just pushing up and up and up. So I think it's a combination of that. I don't think anything's changed from one particular reason or one point in time.
It was like the awareness of what everyone else is doing. Maybe you could call it paranoia sometimes. That's obviously increased with things like, you know, going further back, social media and things. You must have this awareness that, oh, so-and-so's at altitude, so-and-so's at altitude. That maybe raises the level as well.
Yeah, you can see what everyone's doing, I think, to a degree. And some teams are more happy to share it than others. But, yeah, everyone knows when everyone's in Tenerife or in Sierra Nevada. People have been doing that for decades. People were doing that 20 years ago, going to hotels, altitude and stuff. So I don't know. Maybe we're just in the moment now thinking everything's more professional. I think the difference now is the general level. The top riders are probably the same. They climb the same speeds and they pay the same attention to detail. But I think it's the riders at the back of the peloton that are taking it more seriously now, so the whole level's higher. Good as well. It's good to be in an era where everything's... To see these riders, I think there's going to be some legendary riders from my era. There's some eras in cycling where there's just one or two, but if I can finish my career and say I raced with 20 of those, that's a pretty nice era as well. A lot of champions.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Byrne.